Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT Photo, episode number 41, recorded on Tuesday, January 24th, 2012. Ron Haviv.
TWiT Photo is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/TWiT Photo. It's time for TWiT Photo, the show in which we take a brilliant, wonderful photographer, look at their photos, learn about their art, their inspiration, some of their technique. I look forward to this show all week. Partly it's because of my great co-host, Catherine Hall, who really put this show together, from CatherineHall.net, is a photographer herself. We met in Tasmania in 2008. Long time ago, on a photo expedition that Mika Oland did. It was so much fun.
Yes, it was.
And I found you to be such an inspiration, as were all the pros, because it's really in the long run the inspiration for the show. Each pro has a unique style that you're all artists, a unique way of working. And I don't know what it is about photographers, but they're often very articulate and willing to share what it is they do.
Yes, they are. It's kind of interesting. Definitely. And speaking of sharing, you inspired me, Leo.
Yes.
If you go for my tip of the week.
Let's go to CatherineHall.net. That's Catherine Hall's website. And click the blog link.
And I don't love this photo. Don't get me wrong. But remember last week when I was saying how much I hate the iPhone and that I can't get into it?
Yeah.
And you said something that really stuck out. What did you say, Leo?
I said it's not the camera, it's a photographer. Is that what
yes,
I said?
Yes, but you said having limiting tools.
Oh, that's right. It's like sonnets. You know, that limits you.
Yeah, so the things that were frustrating me the most about using the iPhone was, as a professional, you get spoiled. You know, I can throw on a cool lens, put it on 1.2, 2.8, and everything looks cool. There's a nice depth of field, or, you know, lens choices, or zooming, and all these things. You get a little bit lazy. And I realized the problem with the iPhone is not the iPhone itself, it's me. And that I'm not willing to move around and.
Right.
And granted.
And sacrifice.
Yeah.
Sacrifice quality or the ability to zoom in on an image or to focus it in the way you want, the depth of field you want. But on the other hand, it's a challenge. It's an interesting challenge.
It's a learning tool for me. Yeah, it makes me move around. And so that was an image this weekend at a concert that I took.
This is great.
Morgan Page, he's one of my favorite DJs.
I love it.
But Ruby Sky sucks in San Francisco.
People don't like that club.
The sound quality is awful.
Yeah.
So anyway, point of the story is I was inspired by you.
You give me a lot more credit than I deserve, because I'm pretty sure I said, Catherine. I did not say, Catherine, don't limitations prompt growth and a novel approach
something
to a known
like that.
Situation?
Something like that.
That wasn't so eloquent.
That was insinuated. But I sold my iPhone on Gazelle.
You did?
And got $170.
Yeah.
And then bought the new
S.
Yeah, the S.
Yeah, because it is a lot better, the 8 megapixel.
Yeah, the sharpness is not so good.
And it's the camera you have now. We got to get you on Instagram. Are you on Instagram?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram. I don't really do much. Well, but I will be.
That's how you share. Or you could share it on Google Plus. Or
yeah.
Where do you like to share photos outside of your blog, obviously?
Well, Google Plus is hard to get to from Instagram. They really need to put the plug in there.
Yeah, you have to do one or the other.
Yeah. What I don't like about Instagram
is that, you know, they don't really have their own website, so you have to use third-party websites to get into it. Twitter's good.
I use Twitter.
Twitter's fine. Nothing wrong with that.
So, there we go. Well, anyway.
Now, what did you do? Because there's a frame on this. I just want
to. I use Nick. Alex reviewed that
last
week.
Those great tools, yeah.
The Nick software.
Snapseed,
that's available for our iPhones. And then I just threw a film thing on there.
Love it.
To make it look a little bit better than it was.
Yeah, that's by the way why we like filters. That's why everybody likes filters on Instagram and all these programs.
I know. The photo wasn't that great, but I tried to
polish
it up a little bit.
So today we're going to learn about photojournalism. You know that that's my favorite kind of photographer to get on this show.
Your absolute favorite.
I don't know why, but there's just something I just revere photojournalists because they often take great risks. They are both artists, but also in a more practical fashion.
Yeah.
Because they're going out into the real world. And in generally speaking, the ethos of photojournalism is don't modify the photo too much because you're bringing somebody a real experience. So a great photojournalist, talk about working within challenges. You're moving fast. You get one chance for the shot.
Yeah.
You can't use Photoshop on it. This is a challenging art form, and yet some of the best photographers
yes.
in the world ever in history have been photojournalists.
Do you remember in 1989 the one shot of, it was in Panama after the elections, of that VP candidate that
yes.
was getting, that was on Newsweek Time, all the
yes.
covers?
Yes.
He was a photographer.
Wow.
And he was only 24 years old. When Ron took that photo.
Ron Haviv is our guest.
Yes, so we have Ron Haviv today, and he was also known for founding, one of the original founders of the Seven Agency, which is by far the most prestigious photojournalist agency worldwide. So it's a huge honor to have him here with us today, and I'm definitely looking forward to speaking with you, Ron. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to have you. It must be hard when you do an image that's so well known, and you're like, what, 20? What did you say?
20? 24.
24. To then go on. It's like landing on, when you know, Buzz Aldrin, I walked on the moon. Now what? Do you have it? Is it hard to live up to an image that you make when you're so young?
Well, to be honest, I got some really good advice after I took those photographs and was told to immediately forget about those pictures and spend the rest of my life trying to prove that I was really a good photographer and a good photojournalist.
Isn't that great?
And I do that ever since.
That was good advice, wasn't it?
It was.
Just walk away. You're not done.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what kinds of pictures do you like to take, Ron?
Well, over the course of my career, I've spent a lot of time dealing with conflict and post-conflict situations and very historical moments. I've been fortunate enough to see the world change three times. I was in Berlin when the wall
wow.
came down. I was a photographer documenting the effects of 9/11 and just recently been covering the Arab Spring. And it's being able to kind of be one of the documenters of history that really kind of motivates me to keep going.
Is that what your goal was when you said, I'm going to choose this as a career?
No, and to be honest with you, I didn't really know what I was doing. I kind of fell into the world of photojournalism. And after that early success, I kind of understood that maybe this would be an interesting career because my photography could play a role in the process of people making decisions, the process in communicating. And as I started to work more and more, by the time I started working in the former Yugoslavia during that conflict, I started to understand that the camera could also be used as a tool to help protect people, to give a voice to the voiceless. As much of a cliche as that is about photojournalism, it actually is quite true.
It's interesting, the photo, I don't know if you recall, but President Bush actually talked about that image and how that
wow.
was one of the reasons why they invaded
Panama. Why we're here.
Why we invaded
yeah.
Panama. So it is, you say, yeah, I want to change the world, I want to have an effect, but to have that experience at 24, nonetheless, I mean, it must be pretty powerful. So, I mean, looking at your work, dealing with the places that you go and how much conflict is a sort of motivation documenting these places and struggles, how, other than just prompting or wanting to create positive change, how do you do it every day? How do you go into these zones that most people are running away from?
Well, I mean, having done it for so long, I've really had the fortunate experience of seeing the impact of the work. I've even been able to talk to people that have been affected by the photographs and even talk to people that were subjects in the pictures and how the work affected them. And understanding that is really kind of that continuous motivation that you're really, I don't think that one picture can change the world, but I think that the work I'm doing, my colleagues at Seven, what they're doing, we really can actually have an effect. And that's a pretty heady feeling to be able to know that you can actually play a role in the process of trying to help somebody. Maybe it's something as simple as, you know, showing the after effects of the earthquake in Haiti and somebody reaching into their pocket and donating money, in effect, and that money going to give food to somebody on the ground. Knowing that you can play a role in that is fantastic.
Do you? That's interesting because it sounds like you have a point of view. So I think a traditional journalist, at least as we've learned to construe them on the New York Times, you know, has no point of view. Well, I bring you the facts. But it sounds like you yourself come with a point of view about the things you're taking pictures. Is that true?
I wouldn't go so far as saying a point of view. I would say that, you know, I am very, very careful to make sure that my work is fair and representative of the situation, that I'm not taking the ability to kind of push the reader into one way or the other. But when you're down on the ground and you're seeing the things in front of you, then I feel like it is my obligation, not only that, my responsibility as an eyes of the public to present the information to people so they can make a decision from there.
Right. So the story, the point of view doesn't occur till you get there. But once you see what's going on, you're there to document it.
Exactly.
How do you resist that sort of, because you do a form, you're in these places and you must form an opinion or...
You want to advocate,
you wanna,
I'm sure.
Yeah. How do you not go one-sided and tell a story that's a little bit weighted to make it look more extreme than it is?
Well, I think that's it. You don't want to make things look more extreme than it is. I mean, these situations are extreme.
You don't need to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The fact that you're there, you're documenting, and I think the idea is to get the information out. And so, although it has become much more difficult over the years to cover, let's say, both sides of a war, you still try to make that attempt to cover, let's say, the Iraqi side and the American side, or in Darfur, the government side and the rebel side. But you really have to just kind of rely on this responsibility of being fair to the subject. But if one side is committing atrocities and human rights abuses,
you see
then
it.
I would document that.
So, and it's kind of hard when you're in Darfur. I mean, you kind of want to speak for the powerless, don't you? The children.
Absolutely. But I think the photography does that.
Right. Isn't that wonderful? If you do it right, you're giving somebody a voice.
How has it become increasingly difficult? I mean, talking about telling the story in both sides, and it seems like more wars are, especially in the zones that you're in, are guerrilla style versus one state against another state. How has that affected your storytelling?
Well, I think overall it's becoming more and more difficult, no matter whether it's a state versus state or a rebellion. I think that all sides are becoming increasingly conscious of the power of the media, and specifically the power of images.
Yeah.
And if you look at what's happening in Syria today, where the government is trying very hard to control the access for journalists, or if you look at what happened in Iran at the end of their elections when the first Green Revolution started, they threw all the journalists out. Or in Sri Lanka, when they ended the civil war there, there were no journalists to document the end of the longest running civil war in Asia. So it's becoming very, very difficult for us to work, and we have to constantly figure out different ways to be able to get the story.
Do you always want to go in accredited by a major organization, or sometimes do you want to go in under the radar and just go in as a private citizen that happens to have a couple of cameras? How do you get around these restrictions?
Those are options. There are photographers that are now, there was a photographer recently in Syria that went in just with his iPhone and managed to go in as a tourist and was able to document part of the uprising. I think, the idea is like trying to be able to like get the work out there, and as a non-participant versus, let's say, a Syrian photographer, a non-participant national can then go out and legitimately put the work out there and say that this is what's happening without any real question about the motivations of the photographer.
You do get competition now, though, an iPhone, from a lot of people with camera phones, and there are people there. Do you think that kind of photojournalism is challenging your profession?
Well, I wouldn't say that that's actually competition. I think that it's fantastic that there is so much citizen journalism. And
yes.
I think that there's no way a professional photojournalist could be in any of these places or all of these places. So I think that it's great that we're seeing images now from Syria, as we saw from Libya in the beginning, and certainly from other places. But as time goes on, in order to really tell the story and tell the story with authorship and tell the story with the eye of the photographer, it's up to people like myself to go in there and tell the story.
And I thought it was interesting that you say that governments are starting to recognize it's not just the videographer, it's not just the CNN reporter, that in fact the real threat might be the still photographer, because it's so often the case, as in your famous photo, that a single image becomes the story forever and is never forgotten. And we could think of so many single still images from photojournalists that have become the story more so than any video.
Yeah. Definitely. I think of Vietnam War. I think of certain images just stick right up in your head.
Yep.
So risk, I mean.
Oh, you must be. You're a very brave man, Ron.
I mean, have you been, you're talking about the consciousness of the government. Have you been taken prisoner while you've been out shooting? How?
I've had some unfortunate experiences. I've been taken prisoner three wow. times to the point where I had to have governments negotiate for my release, and there have been countless times where I've been arrested. But I've been very lucky. I think that as we all know, last year we lost a number of photojournalists covering the conflict in Libya, and certainly in many other conflicts. Certainly during my career, many people have been wounded and have been killed in the line of what they're doing.
I have to ask, when you're captured prisoner, what's the word? I mean, where are you taken? What's the experience?
Well, I think all the experience, the particulars of each experience are different. The overriding feeling that goes through all of them is that sense of unknown and sense of not being in control, and, right. and the resignation that your life is no longer in your own hands, and that's a very difficult idea to accept.
I'm showing right now images from this summer of the fall of Tripoli.
And these were all taken with the iPhone.
Yeah, that's what's really interesting. And boy, Catherine, we were just talking about that. It's the camera you have. And sure, maybe you'd love to have your 5D, but to be there and be able to get those images and be kind of under the radar as you get these images, it's such a risky time. Are you an adrenaline junkie, Ron? I mean, is this something that you need to seek out?
I have to tell you, being shot at during the fall of Tripoli, it was really not a pleasurable experience. So I'm not really kind of like looking to get shot at and go to war, but I am really interested in history, and I'm really interested in being able to kind of present my view of history. And also, let's say, using Libya as an example, there were a lot of war crimes that took place on both sides, and especially the victors were trying hard to erase the crimes that they committed. And I looked upon the job that I was doing and my colleagues were doing as very important.
Yes.
I think that...
hugely important.
These things need to be documented. There needs to be independent documentation of it. And it's part of the whole truth and reconciliation process that Libya will eventually have to go through, but that I've experienced covering South Africa or the war in the former Yugoslavia and other places where the photography plays a role in helping the country get back on its feet.
So you see yourself as a witness to history? Is that what drives you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it's a very amazing... I mean, going for the kind of the selfish part of it, it's amazing to be able to watch the Berlin Wall fall, or watch Nelson Mandela walk out of prison, or be in Baghdad when the statue falls. And that's, for me, it's very fantastic as an individual. But then to be able to present my view to the audience, that's an incredible privilege to be able to do that.
Well, and we are very fortunate.
Yeah.
As your public, because that's your
from
brave
the
man.
Of our home.
Yeah. And you're going in there. What a privilege to get to watch history unfold.
There was Newsweek editor was talking about how there's a common misconception with photojournalists being adrenaline junkies.
Right.
And she was saying they're not addicted to adrenaline. They're addicted to the human experience. Like, they have this sort of inner need to really share. And, I mean, what better zone to share this human experience when things are – everything's stripped away. It's just raw at that point.
Do you go on assignment? How do you choose these places?
It varies. A magazine will call me and ask me to go somewhere, or I'll come up with an idea and ask a magazine to send me. Or if there's no financial support, I'll go on my own and then try to sell the story later.
And that's, of course, where Seven comes in. Is that why you started an agency?
Well, we started Seven primarily to empower the individual photographer. We, the founders, had all been associated with other agencies, and we realized that we weren't in complete control over all the different aspects of photography, from the business side to where the work would be sold. And we decided to do something different. And we didn't create a new idea. We took an idea that Magnum had done and other people, and China created our own little version of it. And we're now celebrating our 10th year, and we feel like we've been reasonably successful and had some good work from not only the founding members, but the other photographers that have come after us.
It's a great idea, and I completely understand and share your desire to control your destiny a little bit.
Yeah.
And create a way for other photographers to work cooperatively and control, the business side of it.
Is that the main reason why you didn't go the route of sort of joining a lot of the top photojournalists are joining wire agencies, and there's a stability there. Like, they have a regular paycheck, they're sent. Is that why you have stayed freelance? What's made you be motivated?
I found it really difficult to have a boss or multiple bosses telling me what I could do and what I couldn't do. And I felt like if I could really make it on my own and choose the stories that I wanted to do and either, you know, benefit from my choices or suffer from them, then it would be more interesting than kind of being an employee. There are benefits, obviously, to having stability as well.
Right. I do think that that's a common feature of entrepreneurs is we don't want a boss.
We'll work twice as hard as long as there's no boss.
As long as there's no boss. It's a silly thing, but it's not a bad drive at all. We're looking at images from the Haiti earthquake a couple of years back. And what's nice on your website, these are all from your website. You've made multimedia slideshows. And it's nice because you're controlling the view and the point of view, and you've added video. And I highly recommend people go to your website,
RonHaviv.com. Yeah, he has a Vimeo channel, too. On his website, there's a lot of links.
Yeah, this is on Vimeo. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really, really great that you share so much of this with the world. And boy, it's dramatic. It's really dramatic footage. What was the first assignment that you went out on where you saw this kind of dramatic danger, death, horror?
That would be Panama.
That was
my
Panama.
First real foreign trip.
24 years old. What was your reaction?
I was spinning around in circles. I was very lucky to have, I was traveling with Christopher Morris, who's a partner in Seven, and was a good friend, still is a good friend, but had kind of took me under his wing at the time. And it was really amazing to be able to have a mentor in the field. And it really kind of enabled me to figure out what to do and what not to do.
Here's that, just for people we've been talking about, but here's that very famous, one of the very famous shots you took there. Boy, is that dramatic. And this is your first time out there.
Pretty much, yeah, my first time.
You must have been shaking.
I was shaking.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting experience, for sure.
Are you used to it now?
I don't think I'm used to it. I think I've kind of always said to myself, if I find myself considering this kind of like another day at the office being used to getting shot at, then I certainly need to do something else. I think you need to be fearful. You need to be conscious of your safety, those around you, while at the same time trying to get the photographs that you need to get.
How are you staying emotionally connected to seeing these things, but not breaking down?
Well, I think it's a really fine line that each photographer has to find within themselves on how to work in these places. And for myself, I really find that if I completely shut myself off because the situation is so difficult and so hard, then it translates into my photography and it's not as strong. So I have to try to be as human as possible, connect to the people.
Stay open to a horror like Darfur.
Absolutely. But to the point where I don't like just break down and cry and then I'm not taking any photographs.
Right.
And then there's no reason for me to be there whatsoever.
Yeah. Do you worry? I mean, I think maybe, I don't know how you felt about how President Bush used your photo, but it was used for political aim. I mean, it ultimately became a rallying cry for an invasion. Do you worry about that? Does that bother you when that happens? I guess you can't think about that.
It's really kind of like once the photograph is taken and released, it really becomes on its own and takes a life of its own. So as long as the photograph is not being misrepresented as something that it's not, that the captions change or somebody's trying to say something else, then there's really nothing that I can or want to do about it. I think that my idea is to take these photographs, put them out there in the world so people can learn from them, act upon them, and react to them. And and there are different reactions that go on.
And of course, every photographer is looking to create an emotion or a feeling or in the eye of the viewer. And I guess it's really true. You might want to, but you can't control how people are going to react to a photograph.
No, you can't. Because it's art.
It's art. And even photojournalism is art. Tell us about this Blood on the Grass video.
This is a different way to tell the American audience the story about Juarez, the drug war. And I had gone to Juarez on my own to see what was happening there. And I found this story about this high school where they had lost several players during a party. A cartel had thought that the high school party was another cartel, and they attacked and killed several players. So it was quite a big deal in Mexico. And this coach of the football team was trying very hard to keep the kids out of the drug life and keep them together even after losing the players. Mm. So I pitched the story to ESPN, to the magazine, and they assigned it. And I thought it was really an amazing way to expose an audience that's, you know, the reads that magazine is probably not super concerned about the drug war. And so here I was able to combine sports alongside of what was going on in the daily life of Juarez.
Yeah. This is also on Vimeo if people want to look at it. You've put a lot of your photos on the web. There's no big copyright Ron Haviv. How do you feel about sharing your photos? Are you worried about being ripped off? A lot of photographers I know are.
I have no problem with if individual people want to use my pictures for their blogs or web pages. It's only if somebody is profiting off of it, if it's being taken by a company, then I'll fight that for sure. But you know, the work is there for people to see, and I think this is one of the great ways that the work can be used.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's a real opportunity. You can follow Ron on Facebook or Twitter. It starts at his website, ronhaviv.com.
Well, that's the whole point. He's saying, you know, just getting an audience to see.
Right.
He's putting himself in these very scary situations in order to educate the world, and what's better than social media.
Exactly. Yeah, you've got a big share button right on your website, and I think that that's fantastic.
So,
no big copyright, no watermark across the front of it. Just these amazing images.
So you're close a lot. You're using a wide angle. Are you using a wide angle, and are you right up there? And how are you dealing with the fear of that?
Yeah, pretty much. I'd say 99% of the work that you see on the website is shot between 28 and 35.
Interesting.
And, you know, I find it's important to get close, to get intimate. I think that enables the reader to react in a different way than a telephoto photograph, where it's, you know, much further away and there's already a distance implied just by the technology that's being used.
So how are you? I mean, obviously, it requires more skill to get these shots when you're right next to someone. How are you keeping them unaware of you or not changing their body language or expression because you're right there with a camera?
Well, in times of extreme chaos, quite often, like, you are the last person anybody's paying attention to.
It helps if there's a war going on. Yeah.
That definitely helps. And then other ways, when it's like a quieter moments or more of a feature story, it's a matter of just spending the time until the point where people just get used to you and they don't pay any attention to you. And that can often take a few hours, a day, a couple of days, but at some point, you know, this idea of embedding is not only to be embedded in a military unit, but maybe in a family, to the point where they just are considering that you're there or ignoring that you're there and acting as natural as possible. I mean, I think the audience has to acknowledge that, yes, there's somebody there with a camera. So it's possible, like, maybe somebody turned a little different way because they were, you know, because of my physical presence there. But my goal is as close as possible to give you a natural view into whatever we're looking at.
You are our witness.
Yeah, and accessibility plays a huge role in that. How important do you think accessibility is to photojournalists, and what are ways to attain it?
I think accessibility is, you know, a good 75% of what we do. You have to be able to get access to whatever you're trying to do, and you have to find ways to do it. So a lot of it has nothing to do with the camera. In fact, there are times when you don't pick up the camera for a day or two, where you spend time with your subject. Sometimes, especially if it's politically related, you have to tell them that you understand what they're trying to say, and you want to tell the world their point of view. Not that you necessarily agree with it, but you're willing to explore and show, you know, what they're talking about. And I think that, you know, you have to kind of use your strengths as an individual, whether you're good at talking or you're funny or you're nice, and you find a way to be able to bond with your subject so they trust you and they open your world up to you.
Tell us the story behind this picture, because these guys look kind of threatening.
These guys are kind of threatening. Luckily, they're all handcuffed together. Those are...
Did we lose the picture?
Those are gangs in El Salvador. I was doing a story on the gang culture there, which was, you know, very difficult and affecting the nation's ability to kind of grow. And it took a long time. This I was able to get access through the police, but I also spent time with the gang members at their homes and in their meetings. And it took time to be able to get some people to trust you in order to let a camera in.
Yeah. But people do want their story told, don't they?
Yeah, it's really amazing. I mean, people, it's not every day, you know, as a photographer, you think, oh, why would that person give me access? But it's not every day that a photographer comes up to somebody and says, hey, I want to tell the world your story. Can I spend some time with you? And most people actually appreciate that. And they're like, they're very, they're humbled, they're proud, and they're interested to do that.
How was it, you do a lot of gang work. How was it doing stuff closer to home when you photographed in Los Angeles?
Photographing in Los Angeles, I was trying to do stories with the Crips and Bloods in Watts in various neighborhoods. And it was extremely difficult. Trying to get these guys to trust you, obviously a little bit easier with the police, but the actual gang members the reporter and I spent several months trying to get access, and we finally managed to get some access. And one particular gang member was talking to us and kind of felt very comfortable, and he felt so comfortable that he actually wound up confessing to committing murder to us. So we took that interview and photographs and left, and said we'll go and we'll see him again in a few days. And before that happened, we got a call from the district attorney in Los Angeles, who said they had just arrested a guy who had been hired to kill two New York Times reporters.
Oh, jeez.
I had all of a sudden realized what he had said and basically greenlit us to be killed the next time we went back. So luckily, we found out that before we went back. So, you know, one step forward, two steps back.
I want to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you how you keep your... your attitude up in the face of horror, this such global horror. You know, sometimes I don't even want to look at the news because it brings you down, and yet you're going out and actively seeking this. We're talking to Ron Haviv, R-O-N-H-A-V-I-V .com, about his photography. We also have his tips and a couple of favorite photos to take a look at. Before we do that, though, I want to talk about audible.com. I love audiobooks. Do you ever listen to audiobooks?
I always listen to audiobooks.
Oh, good. Glad to hear it.
When I'm driving.
Yeah. Anytime you've got a commute, if you go to the... I go to the gym and spend an hour a day, unfortunately, at the gym. That's the most boring thing in the world. I know I have to do it.
You do
the
gym an hour a day?
Huh? Yeah.
Oh, good job.
I know I don't look at it, but I do. And it's boring. And the only way I can stay interested is by plugging in and listening to audiobooks. I just started something new. Because I just finished my last book. It's 1Q84 that a lot of people have been raving about. I was just looking. There's so many great books. If you go to audible.com, here's The Invention of Hugo Cabret. I don't know if this would be a good audiobook. If you saw the movie Hugo, just nominated for an Oscar as Best Movie, it's a great book because there's a lot of drawings and stuff. But you could also listen to the audio of this. War Horse. I like to listen to the books before I... see the movie.
Yeah, it's way better.
Because frankly, when you're listening to an audiobook, it's a movie in your head, and your head is so much better. If you'd like to get a free audiobook, if you'd like to try it, go to audible.com, browse around, see all the great books. There's lots of good books on photography and other subjects like that, on photojournalism, of course, news. But there's also fiction. There's science fiction. There's music, books, Fire and Rain, The Beatles, Simon Garfunkel, James Taylor, Crosby, Stills and Nash, and The Lost Story of 1970. See, this kind of thing sucks me in. I want to, now that I just saw this. And so this is what happens is you go to Audible and you go, oh, I got to get that. So here's the deal. Your first book is free. You get a credit towards a book because your first month is free when you go to audiblepodcast.com/twitphoto. audiblepodcast.com/twitphoto. And you'll sign up for the gold account. That's a book a month. That's kind of, as far as I'm concerned, the minimum. You're going to do more than that, probably. But you'll find a book, and then that first book is yours for free for the first month. Cancel at any time, and that book is yours to keep. In fact, I've been an Audible member since 2000, for 12 years now. I have 500 books in my library, and they're all still available to me for download in high quality. I can listen on my iPhone, my iPod, a Zune if you've got one, Kindle if you've got audio on your Kindle, many GPS devices. There's hundreds of devices that can play audio from Audible, as well as, of course, your computer. AudiblePodcast.com. If you like history, like you, Ron, I'm a history buff, and I love listening to history on Audible. AudiblePodcast.com/TwitPhoto. Try it free today. Your first book is free. Ron Haviv is our guest. We're talking about his amazing photojournalism. How do you keep from getting depressed? It would make me so sad sometimes.
Well, you know, you see moments of great bravery, of great generosity, people helping. You see the human spirit on the positive side come through every once in a while. And I think you kind of hang on to those moments, and those are the ones that keep you going.
What about decompressing when you get back? And just, I mean, you in such a, talk about culture shock coming from such extreme situations. How do you adjust to normalcy?
Well, I think the key was not very early on. It took me a couple of years to understand how to do it, but it was, I used to come back from conflict and expect the people around me to adjust to me,
right?
Which doesn't make any sense. So when I kind of understood that I needed to adjust to them, and it was up to me if I wanted to be able to participate in my normal world, which is my real world, not the world of conflict or famine or something like that, it became much easier. And I don't really find it extremely difficult to come back. I think what I do find is, I mean, again, kind of going back to the cliche, but it's true. You know, you really appreciate what you have, especially living here in the United States, and you come from a place like Baghdad or Mogadishu or even Tripoli, and you see like how amazing it really is here. And even with all our problems, and I know that, you know, everybody has a different life here, but still, it is much better than in most places in the world.
So your life has been in danger on several occasions, not only being taken prisoner. What's the... there has to be some sort of self-protection, survival mode. Or does it just go away when you're out there?
No, I think if it goes away, then eventually you're going to get killed.
Yeah. It's such a dangerous profession anyway.
Indeed. I mean, pretty much, especially if I'm going to a conflict or some sort of breaking news story, I would say pretty much from, you know, the moment I get on the plane in New York to the time, or until the time I come back and land in New York, I'm pretty much afraid. And you have to use that fear to your advantage. And you have to be able to, you know, again, walk that fine line where the fear is not paralyzing you, that you're not able to work, but it's making you fearful enough to make smart decisions. Now, being said, like, it's not a smart decision to go into a war zone or go to a famine or go to a disaster area. But like, once you accept, like, this is where I am and this is the reality of it, then you'd really try to make the best decisions possible.
In this case, you're going in with Doctors Without Borders. You're going into a war zone in the Congo, just a brutal war zone. And gosh, people, you got to go to your site. I'm going to turn off HD because it's a little hard for us to play this back. But you got to go to Ron's site and look at some of these videos because they're just so dramatic.
Yeah.
So powerful. And you'll really get a sense of what he's talking about, where he's going into harm's way here.
What's the scariest? I mean, do you have like one moment that was the most fearful moment of your career, or is it any stories?
I mean, I find it very difficult to kind of like, you know.
Yeah, it's even.
So just... I, you know, just overall, you know, there are times when, you know, there are very difficult, difficult situations, and I've been very fortunate enough to survive them and be able to work and come out with photographs and stories of, you know, the people that I'm photographing.
Here, we've got two of your favorite photos that you sent us to talk about. This is the first. Tell us the story behind this.
This is a really kind of lovely story. I was doing a big project, or Seven was doing a big project with the International Committee of the Red Cross called World at War to celebrate their 250th anniversary. And I went to the Democratic Republic of Congo to see what they were doing and what the situation was like. And one of the big things that the Red Cross does is about reunification of families. that often are split up due to fighting. And so in this story, this young child had lost his parents in a battle. He went one way, they went another way. And probably each, he thought they were dead, and his parents probably thought he was dead. And so at this very moment, he's being told that the Red Cross has just found his parents, and they expect to reunite him with them shortly.
Oh, my God. How old is he?
I think he's about 11 years old.
Oh, my God. Wow.
So that's the story of how you keep going.
Yeah. There's moments like that. Yeah.
It's a big moment there. I'm very hopeful.
And here's another one. What? Where is this, and what is the story here?
This is from Darfur. I was doing a project with UNICEF on the situation of children in Darfur. And this is a kind of an amazing picture in a number of ways. The first one is being that this young girl, she's probably about 9 or 10 years old, and her two friends are going off in search of firewood. As you can tell in the photograph, there are no trees anywhere to be seen.
Not a lot of firewood.
She's going to have to walk maybe a day, maybe 2 days, to bring back some wood for her family so they're able to cook food. Now, that's enough of a hardship for a little girl to do that. But at the same time, she has to sort of avoid the military, avoid the militias, and try very hard not to be attacked. Because unfortunately, in Darfur, girls as young as 8 have been attacked and raped. Mm. And so I was talking to her. It's about 6:30 in the morning, and I was asking her what she was doing. And I lifted up the camera, and she just kind of bowed her head in that way. And what really amazes me is the way that she's holding herself, that kind of pride and resilience. And then, of course, her clothes are so beautiful. It's like she could be in fashion.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very striking image for me.
Mm.
She looks like a woman, too. She doesn't look like a girl, you know?
Wow. Ron has 3 tips for us, too, so... Let's get to those tips, starting with do your research. You do this before you go, I presume.
It's extremely important. So many photographers show up, especially, those of us that are doing photojournalism, they show up in a country, they don't know the history of the country, they don't know what's going on, they don't know who the players are, and it's extremely important to be able to do that in order for you to understand what you're photographing. It'll make your photography so much better if you know what you can talk about and how you can translate that into visual images. And then, of course, especially now, the way as photographers are doing audio and video and we're interviewing people
right. On
their own, you need to be very knowledgeable about what you're doing.
So how does this illustrate that?
Well, this is actually the gang member that confessed to murder.
Oh, great.
So he gave a pretty good interview. And
you went in prepared.
You talked about how long the difficult process of getting access to this story. Any tips on getting access in these kind of situations?
Well, you have to kind of look for different ways. I mean, eventually we were able to get access because we went to people that were working to help people get out of gangs, like different non-governmental organizations, both like local organizations in Watts and national organizations. And there's always, somebody that, thinks that's important, for people to be able to see examples of what's going on in order to try to tell people, like, gang life obviously is not the way to go. So they would be helpful with introductions. And then it's up to you as the photographer, maybe the writer, or separately or together, to gain the confidence of your subjects.
And in some ways, this guy is just as trapped as that girl in Darfur. I mean, he's a bad actor, but but he's also a victim.
Absolutely. And the things that came out of his mouth are the same things that I heard from people in Darfur, the same things I heard in Rwanda or Yugoslavia or Iraq. And basically, it's like, I'm here, I'm doing what I'm doing because I want to protect my family. That's what's important to me, and I'll do anything I can to keep them alive.
They're surviving.
Exactly.
Yeah. Prepare for a multi-platform end result. You've done a great job of this. When I look at your multimedia, for instance, on your website and on Vimeo, I guess nowadays you have to. You're not just taking still images. It's not just the front cover of Time you're going for.
That's true. It's not only preparing a multimedia thing that I refer to in multi-platform. I think that because audience today is so fragmented, it's extremely important for the photographer from the beginning of the project to understand what is the end result. How do you want your work to be seen? So yes, you want your work in an editorial magazine, in print, and on their website. Then possibly you want to do a book. You want to do multimedia. Maybe you want to have an exhibition. Maybe you want to do a projection. Maybe you want to do something else. So by thinking about all of this beforehand will enable you to be able to accomplish what you need while you're in the field. So there are very few photographers that think they always think about these things afterwards, and they're like, oh, I wish I had done this. I wish I had this photograph because this was, would be perfect in the book. But they weren't thinking about that. Maybe they were only thinking about working for Time or Newsweek or Vanity Fair, and they were thinking about certain photographs.
Right.
So the more intelligent the photographer is before he or she goes off, the better off the end results will be. I'm not saying you have to do everything, but it's important to know what you want to do before you leave.
I love how you decided to get this kid in the foreground. And that look that he's giving is very dramatic.
These are the survivors of the Srebrenica massacre, which was 7,000 men and boys were killed Serbian forces. It was an act of genocide that occurred during the Bosnian War. And they just arrived in safety probably a few hours before I took this photograph.
Mm. Yeah, and they look a little shell-shocked. Finally, use your aesthetics to create a bond with the viewer and the image.
You know, there are several schools of thoughts about what makes a successful photograph. And my personal view is that I think the aesthetics are extremely important. So whether you're shooting color or black and white, the way you're composing the image, the way that the light is falling, all of these different elements are important to make a photograph that's aesthetically pleasing to the eye. But I think it's even more so of importance when we're dealing with these type of subjects because mm-hmm. they're so difficult to comprehend that I want to essentially seduce the viewer into having a relationship with the photograph. So when they actually understand the content, they're hooked and the content becomes that much more powerful.
This is a perfect example because, of course, you look at the colors and the texture and her beautiful dress. You don't know any of the backstory when you look at this. It's just a beautiful image. And you hooked me. And then I hear the story and it's, oh, my God.
Yeah. So then that worked.
It really did work. Yeah. You're a Canon shooter, 5D?
5D Mark II. Obviously, it's great for both, you know, video and stills. I'm looking forward to seeing the new version of the camera that's hopefully coming out.
So are we.
Soon.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Using the Canon, and my two main lenses are the 50 1.2 and the 24-70 2.8.
Now, as a photojournalist, you're probably not using Photoshop to clean up these pictures. Do you use Lightroom or Aperture or something to manage these?
Yeah, there's a little bit of post work that goes on often with Aperture and sometimes with Photoshop, but there's not a lot of post production going on. There's nothing's being removed, nothing's
right.
being changed. I'm trying to stay as true as I can to the original image.
I'm just curious when you say you're shooting video as well as stills. What's your ratio? When do you decide to go from one to the other? Because I always find I'm shooting stills or I'm shooting video. I never think to do both at the same time.
It depends on what the assignment is and what's going on. If it's a new situation where you're not able to really, you're not going to be able to go back and do both, then there are certain things that I assume, whether maybe because of the audio and you need to have some moving images, I'm going to shoot video. But for those that will look at the multimedia piece from Haiti, it ends with a piece of video and then transfers into a still image. So I was shooting video, and then I was like, okay, this is going to be a still image. So while I was shooting the video, you have that capability with the 5D to shoot a still. I haven't gotten to the point where I'm doing frame grabs off of video. And my multimedia is also, the foundation is the still photograph. That is like exactly what I'm basing everything around. I'm not a documentary filmmaker, so that's what I'm concentrating on still. So I'm always going to look for the still image first, and then if I'm creating a multimedia piece, I'm going to find a way to gather enough video and audio to make it work together as a package.
That makes sense.
And there's just talking about editing. Ron, I want to get your opinion on this. You can't do certain things to images, like you said, removing things, altering the image. You can just do certain burn and dodge. That's it. With citizen journalists using things like Instagram and other things to capture these images, Stephen, one of our viewers, brought it to my attention of a Newsweek having an image that had been heavily processed in the magazine. How is that affecting photojournalism?
Well, I think, I think we're in dangerous ground here. I think that there's going to be a point, especially, I think, with citizen journalism, where something's created, put on YouTube or sent out, especially a place where there are no journalists, say, maybe Syria today or Iran or something like that, and it's going to be a hoax, and it's going to manipulate people. So I think that, this is, again, why there still is a need for, true independent photojournalists that people trust, that have a reputation of integrity, because it's so easy now through Photoshop and other manipulations to create images that are, following the angle that you want to tell.
It feels like we've already had that hoax, but I can't think of an example. It is
something. I mean, there have definitely been little bits and pieces.
Yeah.
Sure. I think there's going to be
a big one.
Really major that's going to affect people.
I think you're absolutely right. It will happen. Ron, it's such a pleasure talking to you. RONHAVIV.com is a place to start. I've just followed you on Twitter and Facebook. Your Vimeo videos are amazing. People should go look at those.
Workshop page on his website as well.
What's your next assignment? Do you know where you're going next?
I'm probably going to go back to Mexico.
More drug wars.
Well, I think it's an important story, and even more than that, it's a very American story that I think that people are just kind of tired of. But I think that there are some reasons why we need to keep going back and pushing the work in front of people and telling them, look what's still going on. The government needs to react in a different way.
And your next master class in photojournalism is coming up in Palm Springs in April.
Yep. It should be a lot of fun.
Wow. Boy, would I love to do that. That's just great. So what kind of background do people need to go to something like this?
I think, just like a basic portfolio and an interest in wanting to learn. And
They don't have to be a working photojournalist yet, just somebody who wants to be?
Yeah, they don't have to be a working photojournalist.
Okay. Really great.
Thank you.
Really a pleasure meeting you. Thank you for joining us on short notice.
Yeah.
And struggling through the Skype issues. It actually worked great.
It works great. Yeah. Thank you, Ron. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Catherine.
Ron Haviv. Thank you for joining us. We do Twit Photo every... I love this. It's so much fun. Twit Photo every Tuesday, around about 1:30 in the afternoon Pacific, 4:30 Eastern. You can watch live at twit.tv. But you know what? We make it available for download. We've got, 35 episodes, something like that. I have it right here. 40 episodes. This is 41.
Last week was the big 4-0.
So there's plenty of them. And if you haven't seen them all, my goodness, go back, because every one of them is a gem, just like this one. Twit.tv. Catherine, what are you up to next? CatherineHall.net, your blog. That's the place to go to see your pictures.
I'm working on the show.
She's an eye photographer.
And I'm taking photos.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you for being here, everybody. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Ron.
We'll catch you next time on Twit Photo.